John Belushi was a huge comedy star, TV, movies, records, and so much more until his death in 1982. But the work that he did still survives, as do all of his friends and the legend of John Belushi, which is recounted in a new book simply called Belushi, put together by his widow, Judith Belushi Pisano.
Hi.
Nice to have you on here. You have actually been married to another guy for like a decade and a half now.
I've been remarried as long as the same time I was with John, actually.
So you're still the keeper of the John Belushi flame, huh?
Yes, in certain ways. That's true. That is true. I sort of, I met him in high school and went along on that wonderful and exhilarating and sometimes infuriating ride, and have lived to tell it.
Yeah. Now, you say in the book that when he died of a drug overdose in 1982, that you were riddled with guilt.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I think that's pretty much true of a lot of deaths, even perhaps like a car accident, and you feel like, well, I shouldn't have let them use the car, or I should have driven them. With drugs especially, this is something that John struggled with over the years. He was up and down with it, and at the end he was in a real tailspin, and, I just kept thinking I should have done something more.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to the drugs in a second, but I want to talk about some of the bright spots of his life. Earlier this week, I talked to Harold Ramis, who has a new movie out called The Ice Harvest, and I asked him about some of his other projects through the years, including, of course, Animal House. And he told me that that movie had actually been written for John and Chevy and the other guys.
And Danny.
And the other friends of his from Second City and Lampoon and Saturday Night Live. Were you involved in any of that?
Well, I did work at Lampoon with John and Harold when we did a radio hour. And as far as the movie goes, I was with John, and I did work with the art director some. I painted the togas, and I made some signs up that were around the sex room and the band drum I painted and things like that. I helped find some locations, but I can't say. Oh, and I helped find those pointed bras with Deborah Nadulman, the costume director. That was memorable.
So you were there when they were doing all the filming of the movie.
Yeah, and I was John's dance partner at the toga party, and was sitting on the steps there when he broke the guitar from Stephen Bishop.
Oh, that was you there?
Yeah, I'm the girl. There's three girls. I was on the top step.
So how wild was that filming?
That wasn't particularly wild, but it was a lot of fun. Great group of people, really funny, smart. John had to travel back and forth to Saturday Night Live, which was a little rough, but we rented a house and tried to take it kind of easy for him, because he had to really focus and have those two different schedules, going to Saturday Night Live and having to work nights, and then flying back and having that long day starting very early schedule.
How much of his character, Bluto, was John's device as opposed to Harold or the director, John Landis's?
Well, as you said, they wrote the part for John, and Harold had worked with John for several years at Second City and then Lampoon. Doug Kenny had worked with him on the radio and seen him do a show that Lampoon had called Lemmings, off-Broadway show, and Chris Miller had seen those shows too. So they all knew his sensibilities and what he could do, which was just great. It was tailor-made, and they knew his physical comedy and how expressive he was. And then when they hit the scene, the shooting, for instance, with the scene at the cafeteria, it pretty much said Bluto goes down the cafeteria line.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew John would make that funny. And then between John Landis and John Belushi, they really worked well together. It'd be sort of like, okay, now grab the hamburger. And then John would grab the hamburger and squeeze it out of the bag and stuff the whole thing in his mouth and just take it another step.
Mm-hmm.
And eat some Jell-O. And lo and behold, he'd learned this years earlier when he used to clean up a restaurant. And he and some friends used to go, they're supposed to be cleaning it up, but what they do is actually work on their comedy routines and eat. And they used to have these big vats of trays of Jell-O. And he learned there that you could suck Jell-O right off the plate. So, here's some Jell-O. And
did his success in Animal House cause a lot of jealousy back at SNL?
I don't think so. Probably to some extent, but at the same time, I think it was more just annoying that he was having to go back and forth. And, you couldn't count on him to quite carry the load that he should.
But were people like Aykroyd, and I guess by then Bill Murray was in the cast, and Chevy had been gone. And
Chevy was gone, and no, Danny and John never had any jealousy problems, and I don't think Billy and John did either.
Hmm. What was the role that Bernie Brillstein played in John's success at that time?
Well, Bernie was his manager, and John always liked thinking he had the best working for him or with him, and he knew that Bernie was Lorne Michaels' agent, and he didn't want to sign the contract at first, and literally up to the moments before the first show, they were saying, you can't go on unless you sign this, and Bernie was there, and he looked at me and said, well, what do you think? And he said, I think you should sign it. He said, well, I'll sign it if you represent me. So he said, sure, and sure enough, that's what happened. He was connected. He made the deals, and he was supportive of us and how we needed to do things, you know, when we needed to have a house to be somewhere, he'd help us out. Or, I guess he was probably a bit of a father figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as he has been to many people in the comedy world in Hollywood. Let's talk about another huge success for John, and that, of course, is the Blues Brothers. My brother, who lives in New York, was a huge Saturday Night Live fan. I guess he was in high school when the show started.
Right.
And he would go into New York on Saturday mornings and get into the standby line because he would mail away for tickets and he never got tickets.
Right.
But he would go and spend the entire day at 30 Rockefeller Center in New York waiting to get into the standby line. And he would get in remarkably often. I mean, he probably saw a dozen shows going into the dress rehearsal that they would do in the early evening before the live show later.
Yeah.
And he called me one Saturday night and said, we just saw something amazing. And I said, yeah, I know, you were probably at SNL. He said, yeah, but before the show, this wasn't on the show, before the show, Belushi and Aykroyd came out and sang a whole bunch of songs dressed up as these guys.
Oh, he was there that time.
So, and I guess they were the warm-up act for the show that night,
right? That's how they began. And I did a couple shows like that, only a few. And it was so well-received that they decided they wanted to bring it into the show. But if they literally just put it in as a scene, then NBC... Broadway Video would have owned the rights, which John and Dan didn't want to give up the rights, so they hired them as the musical act, and so they were the actual musical act, and that's how the Blues Brothers were born.
But how did they get on that stage as the warm-up act in the first place? I mean, because, again, you know, you're dealing with egos here, but you're also dealing with guys who have this tremendous love for a certain kind of music.
Yeah, it was a series of things. First of all, the first time John and Danny met, they ended up going to an after-hours club that Danny had in a loft and spending the night talking and playing music. And Danny had a lot of blues stuff, and John was sort of like, well, I know sort of, you know, like Cream and that kind of blues, but more rock and roll, and had this big musical discussion, and Dan was playing John some harder blues. He was going, yeah, I do like this. He said, Mama, it's Chicago. You should know this. And Howard Shore, who later became the musical director at Saturday Night, was there, and the guy said, well, we should have a band. Let's get a band together. And Howard said, yeah, you should call it the Blues Brothers. Now, they didn't even spend time together for a couple of years. And then suddenly there they were, and John, in the meantime, had gotten really into the blues and learned a lot and just was living it. And at times he'd get up on stage with bands and sing, just like down at a club somewhere in New York. And one night we were at a place called Trax, and he got up and sang, and Lorne Michaels happened to be there, and he was like, wow, that's cool. And so I'll get Danny together, and we'll have a band. Keep moving toward that idea.
Yep.
And sure enough, they said, all right, warm up the audience. And so, you know, they decided on their look, and, you know, we had to go rummaging through thrift shops and find big old black suits. And my father used to be a big fan of skinny black ties, and we had sort of finally wrestled them away from him and made him wear whiter ties because it was, you know, the era. And so I called and said, you still have those black ties? So he mailed me a couple of them, and, we got the uniform, and they went and did it.
So Danny Aykroyd was kind of the professor, and John was the student when it came to the music.
Yeah, at first, yeah.
And at what point did the backstory of Joliet, Jake, and Elwood get written?
Once they were on television, they were offered a record deal. And so with the record deal came a live show and a performance opening for Steve Martin at the Universal Amphitheater in California.
Which became the Briefcase Full of Blues album.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
And so we wanted them to look like a real band, like somebody who existed. So we started talking about who they were and, you know, where they came from. And John and Dan hired their fabulous band with Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn and Mac Guitar Murphy and the horn players were the had that Memphis sound, but they were all guys from the Saturday Night Live.
But they'd actually, most of them had actually played on some of the original Sam and Dave stuff.
Yeah, that, Cropper and Dunn, they were from the Stax. They did all those early Stax records and with Sam Cook, and you know, they're just fabulous. And Tom Scott, the horn player, joined them in L.A., and they just had this fabulous band anyway. They so we had been, so like I designed a T-shirt for them. Seemed like that would be good if you had a T-shirt. You probably have existed for a while. And and then when we were doing the album, and we start, you know, you look at a lot of the old blues albums to see, get a sense of the style, and I was doing that design, and I said, you know, it would be great to have liner notes, because liner notes weren't very popular at the time, but they were, you know, really all over those blues albums. So we hired a friend, Mitch Glazer, and we'd given everybody nicknames, and so he was Miami Mitch, and he wrote up this story that had been developing, and that was, you know, sort of told on how they were orphaned and befriended each other as children, and with a gleaming E string became blood brothers, and thus was the legend of Jake and Elwood born.
When they did that show at the Universal Amphitheater opening for Steve Martin, that was the largest crowd they'd ever played for, I'm sure.
Yes, it was.
They must have been nervous.
The studio, which isn't, you know, looks bigger on TV than it is.
Right, but they must have been nervous.
You know, it was a real excited kind of nervous. And that's something John thrived on, actually. He loved to push the envelope in terms of his work, and that's what, you know, people used to call him dangerous, and, you know, the most dangerous man in television or whatever, and it really had to do with that he just really liked to do things that were challenging. And you know, like in one of the reminiscences in the book, Belushi, one of our friends says he thought he seemed very nervous. I didn't think he seemed very nervous myself. I'm sure he was, but I do remember when they went out on stage, and I was standing with them, and they went out, and so then I was sort of watching, I was seeing them from behind with the silhouetted in that light, and the crowd cheering, and it just really was a moment that was, just took my breath away.
Yeah, because you'd already had several of those I can't believe where I am moments,
yes.
Right?
Yes, and that was like, I just felt like, boy, they did it, you know?
And I'm sure
they... in the audience, you know, all these people, it was just crazy.
Did they have that I can't believe where I am moment when they made the movie and they're meeting people like Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think one of the things that John just got such a kick out of when he did perform on stage and sing, and he tried to stay in character, but there'd be moments he literally would just kind of giggle. He would be so excited and so happy with it all. And it was just cute because I'd always notice when he kind of broke character for a minute just to enjoy it.
Yeah, so you'd think, oh, that's not Jake, that's my John.
That's right. Exactly.
Talking with Judy Belushi Pisano, the widow of John Belushi, who died in March of 1982. And those speedballs he had in his arm at the Chateau Marmont in Beverly Hills. She's got a new oral history of John Belushi's life with not only her words, but the words of many of his friends and people he worked with through the years. It's simply called Belushi, and it's out in bookstores now. We talked about a couple of the movies. Let's talk a little bit more about Saturday Night Live, and I have a couple of rumors that I've heard, and you tell me whether they're true or not, okay?
Alrighty.
He hated doing the bees.
That's true, and we covered that in our book. Yeah, he... I think that it basically had to do with he didn't want to be a clown. You know, he didn't like, he knew if he dressed up, he looked funny, but he kind of tried, he really was interested in doing sketch comedy and developing characters. And so he had this aversion to the bee, and probably also it had to do with putting on a silly looking costume and he felt stupid.
Although I will say, when he had the bee antennae on,
yep,
he was able to get them going in a way that looked like it cracked up everybody else on stage.
Absolutely. And the thing was that he, you know, so he brought his anger to that role. So he was always kind of an angry bee. And he sort of see, I mean, and the bottom line is, you know, you stick him out there and he's going to make it work. He will not, you know, he'll do everything he can not to die on stage. So he sort of made it so funny that it just kept coming back and back.
Didn't he and Danny actually do a Blues Brothers thing as the bees?
Yeah, actually, their first time they sang together, they were in the bee outfits and they put on the hats and glasses, and it was just sort of a little surreal thing. So, you know, I don't know if, you know, how he might look back at it if he could. I think it was pretty funny, and he'd have to, he did one bee as a Mexican, you know, bad guy. And
right, as a bandito.
Yeah, the bandito, and it was so, I mean, it was really funny. It was funny.
All right, rumor number two, John hated doing repeating characters.
Well, he didn't want to do repeating characters. He had an aversion to it, but, and that was one problem with the bees, too. They must have done at least 10 bee sketches. But with an exception, he did the samurai maybe 8 times,
mm-hmm.
and he liked that. He enjoyed it, and he thought, you know, he was a little nervous about it getting stale because it's basically the same idea, just put it in a different situation.
Right.
But again, it was such a great character.
Yeah, I think the first time he did it was with Richard Pryor, but it really yes. came alive once Buck Henry came along.
Yeah, because he had such a great way of talking to him. Went to the gibberish.
Yeah.
They would communicate, and it just sounded so funny.
Yeah. All right, rumor number 3, John was afraid of doing Joe Cocker for Joe Cocker.
Yes. That's, you know, it's something for someone to allow themselves to stand next to someone who's doing a parody, which by nature is, you know, meant to be funny, to take all your idiosyncrasies and exaggerate them. So, you know, I'd say it takes a big guy to do that. And
what was Cocker's response?
Well, as I understand, because I don't really remember. It's one of those things you go, I don't remember, and then you ask a couple people, and it seems that he thinks it's pretty funny.
All right, speaking of rockers, there was a book about the first 5 years of Saturday Night Live that talked about 1 week in 1978 or 79 when the Rolling Stones came to do the show. And I remember seeing the show and thinking, wow, the Stones sound like they're burned out. And, of course, everybody's thought that of the Rolling Stones since 1966.
Right, and they're still going.
But I read in that book that it was almost like a challenge to John and the other people on the show to show the Stones that they could out-party them.
Yeah, that was a party week. It definitely was. In fact, there's a picture in the book, and I think you look at them, and they all look tired.
Yeah.
They look pretty tired.
Is it possible to out-party Keith Richards?
Apparently not.
But Mick Jagger, you could. Because the rest of them were up to snuff that night, although Danny's interview with Mick Jagger as Tom Snyder was one of the all-time classics on that show. A couple of other quick things about Saturday Night Live. I loved some of the film pieces that John did.
Mm-hmm.
The one with Marv Albert narrating him as the Olympic athlete who does the endorsement for little donuts.
Yeah, I just saw that the other day. It made me laugh.
Like Wheaties. But what was the one, and refresh my memory on this, there was one where John danced on the graves of his SNL castmates.
Yes. That was a Tom Schiller film, and John was an old man. It started out with him on the train going, or I think they might have edited that part, but it originally began, he was on a train going to visit the not-ready-for-prime-time players' cemetery. And he's kind of reminiscing about, you know, and then he gets out and he's walking through the snow, you know, wondering, why me? Why was I the last to live? Why am I the last alive? And then he gives this really sly look to the camera and says, because I'm a dancer.
Right.
And he starts dancing and the camera pulls back and he's dancing on the grave.
And, of course, the irony is he was the first to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. After Saturday Night Live and the Blues Brothers and Animal House, he tried to do more movies and he did one with Steven Spielberg called 1941.
Right.
Which I guess at the time was supposed to be, let's cash in on the success of Belushi and Aykroyd being big.
I think Steven really wanted, I think Steven kind of wasn't really cashing in. Maybe the producers felt that way. I think Steven just admired Animal House and really wanted to do a comedy. And, you know, his films always have great humor in it. But it's tricky. Comedies are really tricky. And it was kind of like Bluto Goes to War. And there are moments within that film. I looked at it again recently because trying to remember if it was really bad or what. And the script certainly isn't very good, but there are moments within it. And John does a couple of scenes. He lands and he goes through this tent and he's talking to Orson Bean, whoever it is, the colonel. And it's kind of like the food line, the cafeteria scene in a way. He does this quick go around and it's kind of funny. And Danny had some good scenes, actually, I thought.
But overall, the movie was a flop.
Yeah.
I mean,
11-year-old boys loved it.
Yeah, but creatively, and I correct me if I'm wrong, I think financially it was considered a flop.
For a Spielberg film, it was a flop. I mean, it actually made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
It's no Jaws.
Right. No.
And
I know John wasn't very happy with it. It was too bad. It had potential.
Then he went on and did a romantic comedy called Continental Divide.
Right, with Blair Brown.
Now, whose idea was this?
Well, I guess in a way, I saw that script early and saw John in it and thought it was a decent film and he wanted to do something different. And He was a little unsure, and then right before he got nervous about the idea of doing a romantic comedy. But it actually turned into a very good experience. He liked the director, Michael Apted. He trusted him. It was shot up in Colorado. It was a we had a house in the mountains, and they used to pick him up in the helicopter and take him to work. And we had a trainer with us and another fellow who was very helpful to him. And it was a good time. And ultimately, he was pretty happy with the film. The critics were mixed. And, you know, he didn't get the big drove of the fans he had because it wasn't a wham-bam comedy. So it kind of got lost. They didn't, you know, they were afraid to push it as a romantic comedy, which they really should have for the people who might be interested in seeing a romantic comedy. You know, so it's just sort of lost. And but it's one of the films that people constantly come up and say that they just saw it and how great they think it is. So
I was surprised in reading about it in the book, the other people who were considered for the role first.
I forget who.
Richard Dreyfuss, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Robert Redford.
Well, there you go.
And John Belushi. Who doesn't fit here? You know, was part of it that he wanted to prove himself as an actor who wasn't just...
to try something else, to say, I can do words.
Mm-hmm.
I can say things. I can... the character, that was a real... John brought a lot of himself to that. I mean, he actually is the kind of person who is very well-read, and historical and political information in abundance and cultural information, and... he'd wake up in the morning and sit down with his coffee and cigarettes and read the paper for about 3 hours.
He died on March 5th, 1982, at the Chateau Marmont at age 33. Judy, when you heard he was dead, did you suspect it was drugs?
Yeah. Yeah, he had been on a binge. Although, I guess I thought it was probably a heart attack from drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because the drug he, you know, was abusing was cocaine in general.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Had he done Speedballs before?
Not to my knowledge. Certainly possibly he did. I could say it certainly wasn't something he did. I don't think he injected himself before because he was not a needle person. Excuse me. And he had opportunity. And there were years where I did drugs with him. So, I mean, if he was doing that, then he would have wanted to know if I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I, you know, did stop, and he stopped for a time, and he was up and down. And most of the year before he died, he was actually straight.
Did both of you stop because you were bored with it or because you realized you had a problem?
I stopped because I felt that I think I was abusing drugs, but I don't think I wasn't addicted, and I thought the same of him, and he was being the more passionate in everything he did. He seemed to always go farther than everyone else, and I figured it was just if we wanted to lose this from our lives, I would have to stop too, and so I did, and obviously he went through phases where he wanted to quit and was having difficulty, or sometimes when he was binging and didn't want to quit, and it was just up and down for a couple of years, and as I say, in the last year, he had been straight up until the fall before he died. He was straight for a year. I don't think he had any use. In fact, I'm quite sure because he had wanted to get a motorcycle. I said, how about we see if you can go a year sober before we do that, and he said, okay, and then he did have a binge like just short of a year, and he was trying to talk me into that was okay.
Was somebody else responsible for that binge?
Well, I think you're responsible for your own binge. There's certainly things we could point to or say, well, this was upsetting, but, you know, the bottom line is that an addict will always find an excuse. It could even be it was such a good day.
But in the 70s and into the 80s, certainly, if you were a famous person, people were probably pushing cocaine into
Absolutely.
Your hands and up your nose.
Yeah, and that was one of the problems for him was trying to, you know, I mean... Who knows what would have happened if he was... It doesn't mean it would have been a different result. We don't know. But it was difficult to get away from it. And even, like, there was a time when he was sober, and we went into some party, and he walked through. We went through, and we went into a coat room or something like that, a room to put coats, and he pulled out... He'd been handed several vials of cocaine walking through the room. And he just pulled them out and said, he would throw these away.
Wow. Kathy Evelyn Smith did 3 years for involuntary manslaughter for being with him that night and, I guess, giving him the speedballs.
Yes, yes.
Who was she?
A drug... I guess at one time she came to L.A. to, you know, try to be in the music biz, but I guess had her own demons and ended up a drug dealer.
Did his death cause some of the others in your circle to cut back or quit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think two people that have said themselves that it really affected them and changed them were James Taylor and Robin Williams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you? You were sober
by
that point?
I was by then. But it affected my life totally. And, you know, as they say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so I think that as a result, I you know, addressed the grieving, the necessary grieving in the mourning period, and came through a much stronger spiritual person.
How about the parallels between John and Chris Farley?
Well, it's interesting because Tanner Colby, my co-writer, is now doing a book on Chris, and Chris Farley is from Chicago, and he did Second City, and he was a big fan of John's. He wanted to emulate him as an actor, and unfortunately, you know, apparently seemed to think that drug use was part of that. But as Tanner's begun doing his research and talking to family and friends, he said it's interesting because they're very, very different in terms of their background and all sorts of things. It's hard to say why, what it is.
John had a fairly traditional funeral. I say fairly because in that world there's no such thing as traditional, but fairly traditional funeral on Martha's Vineyard, but that wasn't what Dan Aykroyd's idea was for his funeral, right?
Well, are you referring to him leading the hearse with his motorcycle?
No, I was referring to the Viking funeral.
Oh, no, that was actually, that was something between John and me.
Oh.
The summer before he died, we were driving past the cemetery, a lovely cemetery out on the Martha's Vineyard near where we live, and I made the comment that I would love to be buried there. And he said, I want a Viking funeral. So when he died right away, I was getting all these people hopping too, trying to figure out a Viking funeral. But when I spoke with his mother, she was pretty upset about that idea.
What exactly is a Viking funeral?
That's what she said. And I said, well, well, you know, you put a body on a pyre and you cover it with gasoline and you push out to sea and light it. And she said, no. Not, you can't do that in her religion.
Not the way she wanted her son to go, huh?
You'll go to hell.
Yeah.
So I thought that wasn't, I didn't, you know, want to do that to her.
You knew the guy as high school sweethearts. I'm guessing he was a wild man then, and then...
Actually, he wasn't particularly. He was
no?
A football player. Yeah, no, he kind of towed the line. He was, you know, he was captain of the football team, and he was, you know, took his coach's word pretty literally, in bed by whatever time, and no drinking, and all that.
Well, in his 7, 8, 9, 10 years in the national spotlight, he certainly burned pretty bright there. And I'm glad that other people learned a lesson from his death and
yes,
changed their ways. I appreciate your time today, Judy. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
The book is simply... Yeah, go ahead.
May I say we have a website, BelushiBook.com.
BelushiBook.com.
Right, and we have outtakes on it that are kind of nice and a lot of photos. There's great photos in the book.
Yeah, there are. It's a wonderful read as an oral history because Judy talked to a whole bunch of people who knew him and worked with him. And it's a lot of fun to read for anybody who enjoyed his work and wants to know, especially some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, even things that we haven't talked about here today.
Right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Judy Belushi Pisano. The book is simply called Belushi. The show is simply called The Paul Harris Show.